And welcome back to Coast. You're in for quite a treat tonight. If you have been in the news business as long as I have, and you read newspapers or you watch television, you'll know the name Sally Quinn. And in a moment, we'll be talking with Sally about a spiritual memoir, Finding Magic, next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Sally Quinn is a longtime Washington Post journalist, columnist, television commentator, Washington insider, and one of the Capitol's legendary social hostesses and founder of the religious website On Faith from the Washington Post. She writes for various publications, noted author, several books out there, including the one we're talking about tonight, Finding Magic. And Sally, welcome to the program. It's good to have you on.
I'm delighted to be here.
And I've got to thank you for something, because I started in this business in 1969. I was a little copy boy in Detroit, Michigan, and then ended up working for a CBS station in the 70s. And I've watched your career as a journalist. You were on television for a brief stint. But your contribution to the media has been exceptional. And for somebody who's been in the business like I have, I want to just thank you for that. I don't know if you get that very often, but thank you.
Well, thank you. That's very nice. I mean, I don't feel that I've contributed as much as a lot of people, but I've tried to do my best, certainly.
I had Dan Rather on a couple months ago. We were talking about some of his new work, and he's concerned about cyber attacks and things like that.
Right.
What do you think of the state, Sally, of the news business these days? Has it changed much from when you were really, really into it?
Well, you know, people keep asking me that and deplore what's happening to journalism. And, I mean, obviously, one of the things we know is that newspapers, a lot of newspapers are failing because financially, they just can't stay afloat.
Right.
Advertising just doesn't. People just aren't buying newspapers, and they're getting more and more information other ways and on the internet.
It's like the big retail stores. They're getting clobbered because of the Amazons that are out there.
Right. Well, we certainly. I'm not going to say anything bad about Amazon since Jeff Bezos, who's the head of Amazon,
he owns the Post.
And by the way, is a fabulous guy and has done a great job with the Post.
Good. He saved it.
He saved the Washington Post, and it's thriving now. But I think that the quality of journalism, I mean, one of the things is that there's so much media out there, and the more there is, obviously you're going to have the bad with the good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in terms of the mainstream media, or as Trump likes to call it, the lamestream media,
yeah.
I think that the quality of journalism has never been better. I mean, I think the Washington Post and the New York Times have been doing fantastic jobs, as have other news outlets. So, and it's much harder today because in the old days, you'd get your story, you'd come back, you'd sit down with your editors and you'd talk about it, and then you'd write it, and the copy editors would be there, and they would fix it and change it around, and there was plenty of scrutiny before it went out. Now, it's 24/7, so you get a story, you got to get it up.
Oh, that's right.
And online immediately.
It's competitive.
Because you have to get it, as Ben, my husband, Ben Bradley used to say, get it first, but get it right.
That's right. Well, nowadays, too, I mean, there's so many celebrity stories online that they've died, and they're there reading their own story that they've passed on. That's the downside of some of this, too.
The problem with it is that there's so much competition on the web, and because of how quick things have to go up, and because it's very competitive, people don't have time to check and do their homework and do the research. And I think that's where it really suffers.
You're going to love this. You talk about synchronicity. A couple weeks ago, I saw a little snippet about you putting hexes on some people that had died. And I saw that story. And I went, boy, this is right down my alley. I've got to get her on the program. So I sent a message to my executive producer, Lisa. She's in a different state. But with technology, you can do that now. And she emailed me back and said, George, she's booked already, and here you are. Tell us a little bit about your book. It's kind of a memoir about you, because it talks a lot about your life, but it's also fascinating for those people who are into spirituality and the paranormal. I never knew that side of you, ever.
Well, all of my friends did. I mean, my friends have been calling me witchy since I since I was in college. I grew up in, I was Army brat, so of course I lived all over the world. I never lived in one place longer than a year and a half. But I'm from Savannah, Georgia, and my mother's from a small town outside of Savannah called Statesboro. And
how come you don't have that southern drawl?
Well, darling, you just put me down in the South for about 2 days.
Oh,
a couple of drinks.
There it is.
And it comes back. My mother had a very southern accent. But, you know, when you travel around, I mean, I've lived all over the world, you lose it. But so I spent my summers in Statesboro, and my family, the McDougals, had come down from North Carolina. They were good Scots people with the turpentine trade, and they'd built this big sort of antebellum house with white columns right out of Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
And they had a plantation, which now is in the center of the town. But and so we would go and spend our time there, and Aunt Ruth McDougal would play the organ in the church on Sunday. But her real religion was, I mean, she had certainly an alternate religion, which was this whole Scottish mysticism and the standing stones and time travel and ghosts and psychic phenomena.
Everything we talk about on this program.
Ouija boards and tarot cards and palmistry and astrology and all of that kind of thing. And voodoo was part of it, too, because we had, you know, a lot of the staff would go to a church across town, the Baptist church, but they would practice voodoo. And so everybody had these sort of dual religions. And I mean, since I was a very small child, this is what I call embedded religion. It's a religion that you grow up with and know, and even after you've grown up and decided or realized that it didn't make any sense or you didn't believe it, it still sort of sticks with you in some
right.
way, you know. And so so I watched all of this. I actually watch voodoo being practiced. My mother actually put a hex on somebody at one point. And so it was just something that I took for granted. I mean, I never questioned it. It was just, and the other thing was that my mother, her sister, her aunt, my Aunt Ruth, my sister, all of us and I all have some psychic abilities. Not all the time, but we do have these sort of occasional remarkable experiences. And
even at that young age you had it?
Yeah. And so, but again, I didn't think anything of it because we all had it, you know. So from time to time somebody would predict something. I mean, my Aunt Maggie was living in Florida, and she woke up in the middle of the night crying, and she said to her husband, there's been a terrible plane crash in the Okefenokee Swamp. And they turned on the radio, and they'd heard about the plane crash, and they knew the plane had gone down, but they didn't know where. And
yeah.
she called the authorities and told them exactly where the plane crashed.
Oh, my gosh.
And they found it, and they were able to get the people out alive. I mean, that, it's the kind of stories that, you know, there are a lot of stories like that in my family. So I just took it for granted that that's the way it was. Now, I do think that everybody has psychic abilities. I just think that some people are more developed than others.
Right. And some people don't accept it.
They haven't sort of followed through on any way. I just think some people have an antenna that sticks out there. And, you know, sometimes I don't have it all the time. But when I do, You know, it's almost like I can feel my antenna quivering.
Right. You know you're in that groove.
Yeah, just it's kind of, you can sort of start picking things up. So anyway, you know, I grew up with this, I sort of didn't, you know, but I used to talk about it in college all the time. I mean, and I always read people's, I knew how to read palms and tarot cards. I was always reading my friends' palms.
Did you have an audience when you were talked about it? I mean, did you find that people were interested in this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in college, all of my friends. And I knew a lot about astrology and palmistry and tarot cards. And they were all my friends were riveted. You know, we used to have seances, and we, you know, at night, and I would read palms, and, you know, it was all...
Were you pretty accurate?
Always.
That's great.
And so that's sort of been part of my persona, and my friends just all accepted it, and most of them were skeptical, but they were fascinated, and they liked it, and it was quite fun.
Did you hide that in your career? Because it sounds like it's blossoming again now, but during the...
I mean, I didn't, you know, people knew that about me, but I didn't write about it at all. I mean, I remember when Nancy Reagan, you know...
Oh, she was into this in a big way.
Yeah, and, you know, we learned that she had instructed Air Force One not to take off until she checked with her astrologer and got the exact moment when the plane could take off from her astrologer.
Well, she probably was right. Nothing ever happened to it.
And I remember it was that the editorial page asked me if I would do a column about her and defending her because she was just taking an enormous amount of flack. And I just thought, I don't need this, you know. I said no because, I mean, she asked me because she knew, as everyone else did, that I was... you know, that I was really interested in astrology and had my charts read and all of that. But I felt the timing was not right, that, you know, I just didn't want to put myself in the same
right
boat. I looked at all the flack she was taking and I thought, I really don't need this, so I didn't do it.
But now, your mother was into this in a big way too, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so was my aunt and my great aunt, my sister. My brother, who is a real intellectual, got his PhD in religion from the University of Chicago and studied under Mircea Eliade, who's one of the great religion scholars of the world. And Bill did his PhD and partly on the occultism and mysticism and all that. He was the theosophist and was editor of the Theosophist magazine for years, and still is a member of the Theosophist Society. He's also a lawyer. He's absolutely brilliant, and he's now a practicing Buddhist. But we've all had that sort of bent, you know, that
right
sort of interest, all of us. And, you know, I went to Smith College, and you know, so most of my friends were skeptical but fascinated, you know. I mean, sort of. I mean, everybody was a little skeptical.
Until they started seeing things work, I guess.
Right, exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, getting back to the hexes. The hexes, you know, it's kind of a cultural thing. The word hex, I mean, anywhere in the Deep South, particularly Savannah, New Orleans, and you can't walk down the street in New Orleans without going into a shop and finding doo-doo dolls and, you know.
Oh, it's everywhere. And your mother put a hex on, what, the family veterinarian?
She did, yes.
Well, what happened? Why did she get mad to put a hex on the vet?
Because he wouldn't treat our dog. We had this wonderful dachshund named Blitzkrieg. It was during the World War II. And Blitzy got sick, and Mother kept taking Blitzy to the doctor, and the doctor kept saying there's nothing wrong with her, and sort of treating Mother as though she was really stupid.
And
Mother kept saying, I'm telling you, this dog is really sick.
There's something wrong, yeah.
And he kept saying, she's fine. And so we finally, Mother got really angry. We took Blitzy to the doctor, and Mother took Blitzy back out to the car and came back into the doctor and said, you know, you've got to give me some medicine. He was writing out a prescription. She went back to the car, and Blitzy was dead.
Oh.
And Mother just went crazy, and she went storming back in with, you know, holding
the dead dog.
And she said, I hope you drop dead. And he did. About 2 days later.
2 days later?
Mm-hmm.
Now, did your mother feel bad about that? I guess not.
Well, you know, I just don't remember as much her feeling bad about it as that everyone in the family sort of accepted it.
Everybody knew the story, too, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this was in Statesboro, you know, and... So it was kind of like, you know, more than, oh my God, this is so awful. We, you know, it was just simply.
I mean, the odds of that happening, Sally, are astronomical.
Right.
Astronomical. Hmm. Now, she also put another hex on a doctor or a pediatrician somewhere in Tokyo.
Yes, I was in the hospital in Tokyo for. Almost a year, about 9 months. My father was in Korea, and I got horribly sick when he went off to Korea. I was very attached to my father. I was 10, and he was being sent to the front lines.
Oh.
And, you know, I was reading the Stars and Stripes every day and seeing the front lines in Korea. Everybody was getting killed.
Nightmare for a little girl to read. Jeez.
And... So, I'm sure it was psychosomatic, but I just got started getting really, really sick, and Daddy left to go to Korea. I begged him not to go, but he had to, and I couldn't eat, and for a couple of weeks I couldn't eat, and finally they took me to Tokyo General Hospital, and they had to put me on an IV because I would try to eat, and I would just throw up everything.
Yeah.
And so...
You were stressed to the max.
Yeah, and so I literally didn't eat for... I was on an IV for months. And the head pediatrician in the hospital would not allow parents to visit their children because they said it was just too disruptive when the parents left, the children cried, and the nurses were understaffed, and they couldn't handle it. So best just not to have the parents come. I mean, you can imagine how horrendous that was.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So I was in the hospital so sick I couldn't eat. I was on IVs, all these other really sick children, and no parents. And the children would cry for their parents all
sure.
the time. And my mother she joined the Gray Ladies, which was an auxiliary nursing organization, got a uniform. Came to the hospital, tried to get in, practically beat the door down. She was outside crying, and outside, they wouldn't let her in. And I could hear this, you know, and the other children, the other parents would try to get in. I mean, it was just, at one point, my father had been working for General Douglas MacArthur in Tokyo, and he didn't want Daddy to go off to Korea, wanted him on his staff, and my father was a warrior through and through, West Pointer, and he wanted to go to war, and so off he went. And my mother went to Mrs. MacArthur and told her what was going on and begged her to get them to change the rule, and she talked to her husband, and he talked to the hospital, and they convinced him that it just, you know, they were so understaffed they couldn't handle this. But Mother was just outraged, and one of my friends died in the bed next to me.
Oh,
and I realized that, and his parents were allowed to come, and they sat there for 3 or 4 days in, you know, chairs next to his
Sally, parents. Hold on for a second. We got to hit this commercial break. You know what they're all about, so we'll be back in a moment with Sally Quinn. Her work is called Finding Magic, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest tonight, Sally Quinn. Her book is called Finding Magic. She'll be with us next hour as well. We'll take your phone calls. Be back to talk about some of the things that happened in her life. Amazing stories, by the way. Just simply amazing. And welcome back to Coast, Sally Quinn with us, her book, Finding Magic. So, Sally, you're in a hospital in Tokyo, you're a little girl, your mother's upset, they're not treating you right. What happens?
Well, this little friend of mine in the bed next to me started dying, so they allowed his parents. His father was brought back from Korea, and his parents came and sat by his bedside for 3 days. And then he died. And so I realized the only way I could get to see my parents was to die. So I basically willed myself.
Oh, my God.
And I got very, very sick, and they were going to have to do an emergency exploratory. And they called my father from the front lines and said, your daughter's dying. And so he came back from Korea, and my mother and father came, and they were with me, and I had the surgery. And I had this miraculous recovery because my father was back. And I went home after a week, and then Daddy had to go back to Korea, and I immediately got sick and went back to the hospital.
You got sick again.
Of course, I didn't want to go, and I kept pretending I wasn't sick. But I didn't want to go because I had been separated from my mother and my whole family for months and months and months. And it was just such a cruel thing. And in any case, they decided I needed more care. And there were all these wounded soldiers coming in from Korea who were being treated at Tokyo General, but the worst cases were being sent to San Antonio, Texas, to Brook General Hospital there. And so they sent me, and we were on a plane, a hospital plane, that had three rows of litters, five high. No place to sit, just litters. My mother and my brother and sister and I all went back on this plane, and it was probably the most hellish experience I've ever had in my life, because these young soldiers, 17, 18, 19-year-old
just kids, yeah.
And they were, you know, missing legs and limbs and seriously burned and bleeding and blind and, I mean, just everything you can imagine, horrible injuries, and they were and the blood would drip down from the top litter all the way down to the floor. The floor was covered with blood, and all the nurses were, everybody was. It was just, and they were crying and screaming and begging to, you know, some of them to live and some of them to die. And my mother just walked up and down the aisles the whole time, just telling them, that, you know, being the mother, they were all screaming for their mothers. It's heartbreaking.
Oh, my God.
And my mother was, you know, would go and hold their hands and tell them they were loved and write letters to their parents and all this kind of thing. You know, light their cigarettes if they could smoke. And you know, then they would die, and the guys would come with body bags and take them off and put them, I don't know where, somewhere in the hole of the airplane. We got back to Brook General, and I was in the hospital there. My mother came to see me, and one day she walked into the hospital, and there was this guy who had been head of pediatrics at Tokyo General, and she just looked at him. She said, I hope you drop dead, and he did.
Oh, my God. How long did it take for him to go?
I don't know. It was shortly after that.
And
so my mother was sort of spooked by that. But that's two times. But, you know, it was all part of the family lore, you know. And so when I was in my late 20s, late 20s, before I even worked for the Washington Post, so this is like 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I had never actually tried to put a hex on somebody. The thing is, you know, that the word hex is not necessarily a negative word. You can put a good hex on somebody.
Right. Curse, on the other hand, could be bad.
Curse, yeah. I never put a curse on anybody. Yeah. Put a hex. You can put a spell on somebody. It can be a love spell.
Right.
Good. But there is really, I mean, it's sort of a Southern word, hex. It's a cultural thing. But it's nothing more, it's nothing different from a wish or a prayer. You just sort of wish that person ill. And so I was at a party one night, and this beautiful girl was trying to take my boyfriend away. And I was sick to my stomach because he was falling for it, and I just couldn't bear it. I was really in love with him. And so I decided that I'd put a hex on her. And what I wished was for her to just go away, disappear, move, do something, you know, so I wouldn't have to, she wouldn't be around. And a couple of, maybe a week or so later, she committed suicide.
Oh, my God.
And I was really upset. I mean, you know, I mean, it was horrible, and everybody was terribly upset about it. And I, you know, I felt bad, but, you know, I didn't believe that I had, that I was responsible. I just felt really bad about it, because I had put out negative energy in the world, you know. And anyway, several years went by, and the editor of New York Magazine, a famous editor named Clay Felker, I had just been hired to be the first network anchor woman in America for CBS Morning News. And I had gone up to New York to do some publicity, and Clay Felker was running New York Magazine. And he had been a friend of mine, and he assigned a story about me, and it turned out to be the worst hatchet job you've ever seen in your life, and just filled with lies about me. I mean, just really horrible. It was the worst piece you've ever read about anybody.
What got under his skin to do something like that?
He wanted readers, you know?
Yeah.
He just thought, and boy, did he get them.
He did. He built that publication, didn't he?
Yeah. And, you know, he was very provocative, and he just thought this would sell, and it did. And it was, look out, Barbara Walters, I'm coming to knock you off your throne kind of thing. And anyway, it really hurt me. In fact, you know, it set up me, my reputation, in a way that I'm still trying to live it down.
Really?
Yeah, even 50 years ago. That often people will refer to that piece, or that was the first thing they ever read about me, and never kind of forgot it. And it was just unbelievably painful. And so I put a hex on him. And so my goal in the doing these hexes was, or whatever you want to call them, spells, was really to have the person feel the pain that I had felt.
Right. You didn't really want them to die.
I didn't put that kind of a hex on them. I just, you know, with the young woman, I just basically wanted her to go away. And with him, I wanted him to feel the same kind of pain that he'd inflicted on me. And, well, shortly after that, he was fired. Somebody else bought the magazine, fired him, and then he got cancer, and then he died.
He died of throat cancer, didn't he?
Yes. And so I felt really, but, you know, it was a long time coming, but I still felt really bad about it, because that was not my intention. And I didn't, you know, intellectually, I didn't believe that I was responsible for that. But, you know, and I was telling, my friends all knew about this, and so did my husband Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post, and he was a total skeptic, and he didn't believe any of it, and thought it was ridiculous.
He was a tough news guy, wasn't he?
Very tough news guy. And, I mean, so everybody laughed about these my hexes and my palmistry and my astrology and all of that, and my psychic moments, and it was just something that my friends knew about me and accepted.
Who hired you at CBS? Was Ed Joyce the president at the time?
Who?
Ed Joyce at CBS?
No, Gordon Manning.
Ah, okay. Right people there.
So anyway, I finally, the last time I ever did this was when my son Quinn was born. And it's a long story, but I had had his chart read by this wonderful astrologer, Caroline Casey, who was completely brilliant. And I mean, she's been reading my chart for over 40 years, and she's never been wrong. But
that's a gift.
Caroline is I mean, you know, anybody can read a chart. You can learn to do it, but it's the interpretation of the chart that makes the difference. And Caroline is not a prognosticator. She basically sees the chart as a map of your life, and so she can sort of tell you who you are. I mean, it's more like therapy than anything else,
right?
Really,
but it works.
It really works, and but there was this really awful woman who was an astrologer who everybody sort of toyed with. And she did a lot of famous Washington people, and she called me up, and she was Russian, and she said she wanted to read my chart, give me a free reading for Quinn for a birth present. And she had been angry at me because I had gotten her to do a column for the Washington Post and sort of writing about politicians doing their charts, and it was very popular for a while. But she was very political and started gearing their readings to her politics, and so she would
slant
very negative readings to people she didn't agree with politically, and I thought it was medical malpractice, really. And I told her so in the end, and I also told the editors, and they fired her, and she blamed me for that. So then she got very sweet and said she wanted to give Quinn, my son, a reading. And it was horrible. I mean, she said that he was going to be retarded and that he would never have a life and that he was going to be gay and all of this kind of stuff. And she sort of cooed at me and said, I'm so sorry, dear, but this is, you know, the stars are never wrong. And I realized she was just doing this to me to pay me back.
Was that the Svetlana lady?
Svetlana, yeah, that's right.
Godillo.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I was devastated when she told me all this, and then I started thinking about it, and I just thought, this is insane. You know, I don't believe this. I think she's doing this. But it really upset me. I mean, here's my new baby who...
Oh, my God.
Well, yeah. And he had been born with a heart defect and it almost died and was in and out of the hospital. I lived in the hospital for 3 months with him. It was just such a cruel thing to do. And so I put a hex on her, and she dropped dead.
Jeez.
Of a cerebral hemorrhage when she was 55.
Tell me you like us.
Well, you can imagine how upset I was.
Oh, of course. You know, it's
and my brother, as I said, who is this brilliant PhD, said to me, you know, you really have to stop doing this. He was talking about the law of threefold, you know, that anything negative you put out will come back at you threefold.
Yeah, at least three, maybe more.
And so, you know, I didn't know whether I believed that or not. I never once believed that I was responsible for what happened to these people. But I realized that it was just too weird and too creepy, and I just couldn't do it. But Bill just said, you cannot do this anymore.
What was the story, Sally, where you saved your mother from almost a homicide case? What happened?
Well, I'll just tell you is that Bill convinced me never to do it again, and I never did, and that's almost 40 years.
40, you haven't done it since?
Never once, and I've never even wished anybody ill. And believe me, that's taken a lot.
That's not easy, because your brain takes over sometimes.
Right, that's right. But I just will not allow myself to wish anybody ill. Never. I believe that you can put out good energy. I mean, I put out good wishes and good spells and good hexes and good prayers. And it makes me feel better. I didn't feel good when I was putting out bad energy. And, you know, I'm a totally different person from the person I was then, you know. Right now telling you this, I don't believe that I was responsible. And in fact, I've been, I've given a number of talks about my book to various audiences. And I always ask people, because, you know, there are a lot of skeptical people, and I ask them, so what do you think? I mean, do you think that I was responsible? And there's not one single person I've asked who has said yes. You know, they all believe.
See, I don't think you were responsible directly, but
no.
I think intention takes over. from all of us. Mm-hmm. You know, we've done experiments trying to minimize Hurricane Irma, by the way.
Right.
And it seemed to work. It's strange, but it went from a Category 5 before it hit Florida down to a 1 or a 2.
Mm-hmm.
I can't take credit for that with this audience, but there's weird things that happen. And sometimes intention, whether you want it to happen or not, kicks in.
Well, they you know, there's all kinds of studies that show that people who are prayed for in hospitals,
it works,
get better
faster
than people who are not, or people who believe in something and if they believe it'll work, it works. So, but who knows? I mean, it's all part of the mystery of life, really.
Did you buy a haunted house once?
Well, probably more than once. But you wanted me to tell you about my mother.
Yeah, we're going to come up to a break pretty soon, so let's start it, and
I was at Smith College, and I had a very bad feeling suddenly one afternoon about my mother. Just I was stricken, and I ran down the hall to the one phone in the hallway. This is way before cell phones. And called home, and we were living at Fort Myer, Virginia, on the Army post, and and the phone rang and rang and rang, and there was no answer. And I thought, this is not possible, because we had two military orderlies who were living there, and there was always, always someone in the house. We lived right on the parade ground. And it rang and rang and rang, and I just kept thinking, something horrible is happening to my mother. And I wouldn't put the phone down. I just let it ring. I don't know how it could have rung 50 or 100 times. And I just sat there on the floor in the hall letting it ring, and I was just frantic. And finally, this man picked up the phone, and it was one of the orderlies. And I said, what's happening? Is my mother all right? And he said, well, she's actually not all right.
Oh, my God.
I could hear my mother crying in the background. And I said, what's the matter? What's the matter? And finally, she pulled it together, and she got on the phone. She was crying so hard she couldn't talk.
Hold on right there, Sally. We'll pick up that story when we come back. Final hour to go with Sally Quinn, and we'll also take your phone calls. And then I'm going to ask her about how she met Ben Bradley. Yep, that's right, the same guy that was part of that whole Watergate investigation with the Washington Post.